Well, there's been plenty of reaction to this month's new FDA orders limiting the use of the antibiotics cephalosporins in food animals to try to tamp down on the drug-resistant bugs caused by too much antibiotic use. But then in December, the agency withdrew a promise made in the 70s to regulate penicillins and tetracyclines. The FDA creeps forward, wrote the New York Times editorial board. Then the LA Times quotes the Pew Center's critics of the overuse of antibiotics, saying that the FDA moves may be a good sign. How can that be? We want to take a minute to look at all of this with Maren McKenna. She's author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. Maren, what gives?
This is complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the backdrop here is that in the United States, 80% of all the antibiotics that are sold every year go into farm animals, and the vast majority of that is healthy farm animals. In other words, they're not used to treat animals that are sick, which no one disagrees with. They're used either to help animals put weight on faster so they can be sold more quickly, or they're used to protect animals from the conditions in which they're raised in very large confinement farms. That's almost 29 million pounds a year. Now, the vast majority of those, of that 29 million pounds, is penicillins and tetracyclines, which the FDA has been trying to control since 1977. Cephalosporins, the subject of the most recent ruling, are only a tiny fraction of that.
We understand cephalosporins make up less than 1% of total antibiotic use on livestock.
There you go.
So it's tiny.
So you can see, since that's such a tiny percentage, why people would be frustrated. People who want to see antibiotics controlled are very frustrated that the FDA could not get this 34-year-old attempt to get the vast majority of antibiotics controlled, that they finally were essentially pushed back by Congress and industry and conceded that they were going to try voluntary reform instead. But on the other hand, the fact that they're willing to control any antibiotic, and that applies to the cephalosporin rule, that does seem to be positive.
Well, and Laura Rogers, who's with the Pew Centers, pointed out that maybe dropping the plans to limit the use of penicillin and tetracycline signal that the FDA intends to regulate more than just a few drugs. Are there many more than those three we've just mentioned?
There are a whole bunch of classes of drugs, but penicillins and tetracyclines, which are the ones that the FDA has been trying to control since 1977, those are the ones that make up the largest proportion of antibiotics used in farm animals. But the reality is that most of the classes of drugs that we use in humans in medicine are also used in farm animals as well. So it's not just a question of one drug or two drugs. It's most of our drugs.
Well, and remind us, I mean, we've gone over this before, but it's worth reviewing. The problem is that when people then ingest all of those drugs that are in those animals, they're taking in more antibiotics than they even know and building up resistance to antibiotics. It not only is in the animals, it leaches into the ground where the farms were. It leaches into water. Too much taking in of antibiotics makes them useless.
Right. And when we give antibiotics to healthy farm animals, what happens is we set up a kind of Darwinian battleground within each of those animal systems in which weak bacteria, bacteria that are susceptible to those drugs and can be killed by them, disappear. And the living space that they cleared out is then occupied by bacteria that have already developed some resistance. Then the animals are killed, and most of the bacteria that were being affected are in their guts. When animals are slaughtered, most of what's in their guts gets on their muscle meat at some point. So the resistant bacteria can leave the farm via the animal itself, but also can leave the farm via the animal's manure. Most manure goes into things that are called manure lagoons, where it sort of ages for a while and sometimes is used as a fertilizer on other crops. But there's lots of research that shows that those manure lagoons dry out and dust containing bacteria flows off them, or they leak and they leak down into groundwater. Sometimes that dust even ends up on the clothing and in the systems of farm workers who are then at risk of resistant infections themselves and also at risk of bringing the bacteria home to their families, too.
Well, but okay, little devil's advocate here, because, of course, there's been an intense lobbying effort on the part of drug makers who, as you just said, 80% of the antibiotics sold go to these farm animals, only 20% go to humans. So that's a huge market there. But also the meat industry, which now, as you said, to meet demand for meat, is packing animals side by side in these huge warehouses. And you know, they claim they need to inoculate them against illness. What about criticism we hear from those quarters? You know, I can see someone saying, well, if you weigh needing to have meat for people to eat against this scenario that's being painted of these outbreaks, well, we don't really hear about that many outbreaks and we need the meat.
So let me unpack a couple of things that you just said. Yeah. The first is we have to use the drugs because we need the meat. The reality is that agriculture has to use those drugs if it's going to raise livestock, meat animals, in the way that it currently raises meat animals, because very large-scale confined animal feeding operations could not exist if not for the routine use of antibiotics. There's just too much potential for sickness in the animals. Now, to the question of whether it really makes people all that sick, there's a lot of antibiotic-resistant illness out there. Most of it happens fairly far from farms. It happens in hospital ICUs where people develop, at this point, effectively untreatable bacterial infections. Mm-hmm. It happens in the vast expansion of the community epidemic of MRSA or MRSA, where now athletes get it, kids get it, people in military barracks, people in gyms get it. There's no direct connection between a child playing football who's getting MRSA and the evolution of MRSA in a pig on a farm that's been given tetracycline. But the magic, in a sort of negative way, of the development of antibiotic resistance is that once those resistance factors, that resistance DNA, evolves and gets moving into the environment, it can go anywhere.
Yeah. So the industry is claiming that they need to use these antibiotics because of the way they raise animals. Critics of the way animals are raised say, you know, you wouldn't need the antibiotics if you raised them, let's say, you know, if they were grass-fed. But does the industry make a point that they could never meet the demand for meat if they didn't warehouse animals the way they do?
If animals were not raised in the form in which they are raised now, prices for their meat might go up a bit. There's a couple of studies that have addressed that, but I have to say the price does not go up that significantly. The second part of that is a claim that you often hear, which is that we need concentrated agriculture in order to feed the world. And again, there's studies on both sides, but there have been some fairly recent studies, I think from the UN organizations, that say actually that we could step back from some of these intensive uses and still feed the world. The question that has to be asked, though, is how many of these external effects, these effects that occur way off the farm, are we really willing to tolerate? Are we willing to tolerate there being untreatable infections in hospitals? Are we willing to tolerate that kids are at risk of MRSA infections that may kill them when they play football in school? Are we willing to tolerate that we're running out of antibiotics because of the evolution of resistance and because drug companies don't make new antibiotics anymore? Are we willing to tolerate that no one's figured out how to make a vaccine for these? Or are we going to look at all these effects, all these external effects off the farm, and say, you know, we really need to control this?
We're talking about the recent FDA decisions limiting some use of antibiotics in food animals, but not nearly enough, critics say, to stem the tide of drug-resistant infections. Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, is our guest. And Maren, critics like Representative Louise Slaughter say the farm industry has long known it has to change. Instead, they moved further into warehousing animals and needing antibiotics. But others in the industry say they need time to change. What's true historically?
When you look at the history of how this issue evolved in the United States, it's pretty clear that for about 30 years, this hasn't really been a scientific issue. Yes, you do hear the claim that more research is needed. Well, on any scientific issue, you could always say that more research would be useful. But when you look back, you can see that in 1969, the government of the United Kingdom was saying, this is really a problem, the amount of antibiotics we're using. In 1976, there was really fundamental research here in the United States that established the same thing, that when you give antibiotics to farm animals, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, identical bacteria, show up in both the farm animals and in the farm workers. Then, in about 1978, as the FDA starts moving forward on trying to regulate these antibiotics, Congress steps in and keeps saying, more research, please. The FDA keeps saying back to them, but we think we have all the research we need. And then the FDA would commission another study and submit it to Congress and commission another study and submit it to Congress. And that's really where we've been for about 20 years.
What do you think happens now, Maren McKenna? We started off by saying that the recent announcements by the FDA that critics of the use of antibiotics might see as disappointing might actually be good news, and that the agency is at least doing something to restrict the use of at least one antibiotic. And yet in that December announcement, putting off plans to restrict two others, penicillin and tetracycline, the agency said they wanted to focus efforts on the potential for voluntary reform. Do you see any voluntary reform?
You know, what I see reluctantly, and I hope I'm wrong, is that we're probably looking at least a year in which there won't be any significant movement because we're in an election year. It just seems unlikely to me that they're going to take any bold steps, but I hope I'm wrong.
Well, meanwhile, antibiotic resistance adds an estimated $20 billion to healthcare costs in the U.S. That makes for longer hospital stays, as you mentioned. I mean, just actually, it's worth mentioning again, people are dying of MRSA.
Absolutely. When the just MRSA, just one of those antibiotic-resistant organisms, almost 19,000 deaths a year in the United States, possibly 7 million doctor and ER visits every year. Every time someone in the hospital contracts MRSA as a hospital infection, they stay up to twice as long. Their care costs up to four times as much. Antibiotic resistance is a huge public health burden on our society. It takes a lot of money we could be spending on other things.
And by the way, you mentioned someone dying playing football in high school. How do they pick the resistant pathogen up there?
So the deaths and illnesses that have occurred in athletes, both pro athletes and college athletes and student athletes as well, have mostly been due to MRSA or MRSA. That's the acronym for drug-resistant staph. That's a particularly tricky organism because all staph, not just drug-resistant staph, actually lives with us all the time. It lives on our skin and in our nostrils. And so long as it's on the outside of our bodies, it doesn't make us ill. But when it gets to the inside of our bodies through a cut or a scrape or a surgical incision, or sometimes because the bacteria itself has picked up the ability to break through intact skin, it can make us devastatingly sick with bone infections, infections of the valves of the heart, bloodstream infections, pneumonia, and it can kill. It happens that staph particularly likes skin that is warm and damp and salty, which is almost a perfect description of what any athlete, especially a kid athlete who doesn't wash up after gym class, the sort of condition that they're in. And so they're kind of uniquely vulnerable.
What can the average citizen do? I mean, there's activists on this issue, but I'm thinking, there's a great old cartoon strip, Pogo, and one of the panels said, "We have met the enemy and it is us." I mean, people are also fueling this by buying the meats that come from these warehoused animals. And yet right now, even people who would like to switch to sort of undercut that industry, it is more expensive right now to buy, let's say, free-range grass-fed meat, meat without any antibiotics in it. So what can people do?
It's difficult because the reality is that antibiotic resistance is a kind of slow drip problem. It took a long time to get going, and it's going to take a while to walk it back. And any individual thing that we think we can do to affect it seems so small. But there are things that we can do to help the problem and as an expression of good faith that we want this to change. It's important to say that some of the problem of antibiotic resistance is due as well to people misusing antibiotics in human medicine. So we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't ask for prescriptions when we don't have bacterial illnesses. We shouldn't ask our doctor for prescriptions if we have a cold, or ask to put our kids on prescriptions because we need to get them into daycare because they have a sniffle. Doctors should be careful to coach their patients when they don't actually need prescriptions, which is difficult. In hospitals, healthcare workers should do a much better job of washing their hands because that's what transmits antibiotic-resistant bacteria from patient to patient. It's astonishing how few of them still do. But in the case specifically of antibiotic resistance as it's emerging from agriculture, really the most important thing we can do is to vote with our dollars because antibiotics are what keep cheap meat extremely cheap. There's some data that says that if you allow for the cost of living, the price of a hamburger in the United States effectively hasn't risen in 20 years. Mm. So what we could do is support instead the sector of agriculture that's working to try to find solutions to this, to not routinely using antibiotics. As I said, there is some research that says that as this sector grows, the price increase is not going to be all that great, but the benefit is going to be enormous.
Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. Maren, thanks so much.
My pleasure to be here.